This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. Today, a conversation with Spyros Batistatos, President and CEO of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. And among the topics we'll take up is his take on the news on Friday from White Lodging Services that even though we have a temporary reprieve, that the Star Plaza Theater and the Twin Towers nearby are going to be torn down. Also, we'll have with us IYI, Indiana Youth Institute President and CEO Tammy Silverman, to talk about the latest Indiana breakout of the data from the annual Kids Count Data Book. And we'll bring you another in the series of reports from Great Lakes Today, this time talking about Asian carp and how we're trying to keep them out of Lake Michigan. That and more coming up. In less than 6 months from now, the final performances will be shown at the Star Plaza Theater in Merrillville, and the building will be closed. It was, I guess, last August, if I recall right, was when had been plans to have the building closed and vacated and even torn down. But there was a reprieve, and that's why the Star Plaza has been open and has been giving performances from different artists over the year, almost a year ago. But come this fall, in fact, we'll see the last of the artists perform in December. The plans from White Lodging Services is they're going to go out with a bang. They're going to have the Oak Ridge Boys, which, according to the company's publicity, says has been the only group that's been performing at the Star Plaza Theater every year since it opened. And that's what White Lodging Services says. And we know that a lot of people have come to performances over the years at the Star Plaza Theater, but changes are coming. And we're going to talk about that as well as a lot of other good news, too. We have Spyros Batistatos, who is the president and CEO of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority, in the studio with us. Spyros, thank you for joining us today.
Chris, it's a real pleasure to be here.
First, let's talk about the bad news here. Let's get your take on the Star Plaza Theater. You were here, of course, around in the last conversation that we had on the program. Here was you and Charlie Blum, who at the time was working as the head guy at the theater, and a good conversation talking about what was going to happen or looking at the history of the theater itself. And I understand you had a chance to talk with some folks in the executive suite at White Lodging Services not long ago talking about this entire development project. Tell us what they have told you and what you have taken away from that conversation.
Well, the announcement for me is bittersweet, as it was the first time it was announced that it was closing. That's where my career started. My second job was at the Holiday Star Theater at the time. And so to me, there's a lot of great memories of people and concerts and just, learning a lot and coming up through management in that organization was clearly very impactful to me as a person and as a professional. So I'm very saddened by the news that building will be no more. Having said that, with everything, there is a life cycle. With everything there is. It's built, it matures, and it possibly goes away, or there's reinvestment in it. And so we see changes all around us, and we shouldn't be surprised that this will no longer be the case. It has outlived its usefulness. The music industry, I believe, as we talked the last time I was on, has changed dramatically by evidence of the smartphone in your hand, where you can now hear a song, Shazam it, download it, have it on your phone and listen to it within 20 seconds, never having known who the artist was previously, never having purchased an album, quote unquote, never having gone to a concert. So the disintermediation of the music industry and how non-traditional it is now distributed, I think, has caused a lot of businesses like the Star Plaza Theater to have to change. Having said that, we're being told currently, and again, it's subject to change because guess what? It's not our property. It's privately owned, and it's, I'm told that it will be a very upscale development, a couple hundred rooms, 20,000-30,000 square foot of meeting and ballroom, a very low density development with some luxury restaurant or two perhaps. And beyond that, I really don't have much insight. It is very much Bruce White's mind right now on what kind of fitting tribute that he wants to leave for his father on that site. And I'm not sure anyone knows what that is. But like everyone else, I believe I'm looking forward to seeing it. We're very excited about what it could be. But it is what it is.
Does it seem that maybe the real surprise, not the fact that the Star Plaza Theater is going away, but that the Twin Towers office complexes are coming down as well, too? Was that in anybody's thinking?
You know, again, I don't have my finger on the pulse of commercial office space in the region. That's not my expertise. So I can't tell you if it's a profitable venture or not. Just looking at, bare information, those buildings are 35, 40 years old. Are there different technologies? Are they, is this the model of today? I can't answer you. I'm guessing that the good people at White Lodging Services are a lot smarter than I am, and they crunch those numbers very keenly before they make huge public announcements about tearing stuff down.
And certainly, I'm sure with so many offices located in those towers that the tenants there are going to have plenty of time to look for more space. Judging by what the Post Tribune story had mentioned about the fact that the leases are continuing, they'll let them live out the leases and give an opportunity for the occupants to move out by this time next year.
Yeah, they're going to be very accommodating, I would guess. White Lodging doesn't have the reputation that it does for excellence and quality and friendliness. They're in the hospitality business. I can't believe they're going to be, putting a foot to people and saying get out. So I'm very confident that it'll all be very smooth and a great transition. And like everyone, we look forward to seeing what's going to end up there.
It sounds like at least you feel very excited about this prospect of having this huge tract of land on the northwest corner of I-65 and US 30.
From our interactions with White Lodging over the many decades, they are very, very smart developers, and I'm very confident that what they have coming in there in their mind's eye right now, whatever that is, will be an asset like what was there was for 40 years. So I think we all need to take a step back, enjoy, go to a concert or two before it's over so we can relive our youth and move on from there.
Well, there'll be lots of activities planned crammed into the Star Plaza Theater schedule here before the end of the year, to be sure, I would imagine now.
They are. So.
Taking a look at some other things in the area, it was summertime. We have lots of events that are happening around the region and opportunities for folks that if they want to get away, but not get away literally from Northwest Indiana, have a little staycation action. Tell us about some things that are happening the CVA is talking about these days and how that's going to help benefit Northwest Indiana residents.
Well, right now, we just got a great calendar of stuff. This is one of the best times of the year in the region. All kinds of events starting in just a couple of weeks. Cedar Lake Summerfest, the Newton County Fair, Greek Fest, which is near and dear to my heart at St. Constantine and Helen. Festival of the Lakes, got to say Hammond has got a great lineup this year with Cool and the Gang, Bush, Limp Bizkit, Flo Rida. It's going to be a great, great season there. Pierogi Fest, if you haven't been to Pierogi Fest, I don't know where you've been. But you need to get to that. Our South Shore Car Show at Fair Oaks in August, the Lake County Fair in August, Touch of Dutch in DeMont in August, and then, of course, kind of the season closer, the Popcorn Fest. And there's hundreds of other festivals in between there. It's almost literally impossible. Just a great weekend last week on the Square in Crown Point with their food truck festival they had. There's just – if you can't find something to do in the next 2.5 months, then I don't know where you're looking.
Well, you've got communities like Griffith. They have their big barbecue.
Rock and Rails Fest is coming on. Their barbecue fest is coming on. Everybody's got something.
Month, yeah.
So come visit our website at alongthesouthshore.com, and you will find almost every event that's going on.
One of the other things, too, I note here, things that have gotten the CVA involved in recent years has been the very famous and I'm sure in a way profitable South Shore Line posters. The poster line, I understand, exhibit is picking up an encore, and it's going to be out there for people to see.
It is a very popular, it's hard to describe the feelings that people get when they come in and they see all of those original South Shore posters in one place. We were able to have an encore presentation coming up in a couple of weeks, so we invite you to come back. We have plenty of them for sale in our gift shop, and it's just it's always a great exhibit to see all of those in one place.
One of the other things that came across the desk just today, as a matter of fact, was word, and we've talked with the folks involved in this on the program here in the past, Making Paradise, which is this rather innovative documentary that took place in Valparaiso, has picked up a nomination for Best Documentary Film for the 2017 Prince of Prestige Academy Awards. I never heard of this, but I'm sure somebody has. And it sounds like it was an interesting movie to begin with, I understand. And a lot of people, when it was shown for the public showing at the Memorial Opera House in Valparaiso, a lot of people took advantage of that chance to see the film there. It was just a very interesting and innovative film in its own right.
Well, I've come to learn in the past 27 or 28 years or so that anything that Bill Wellman's involved in is interesting. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the seven makers of that film. I have not had a chance to see it yet, so I'm anxious to see it. But I'm not surprised that it would be nominated for some kind of award, given the passion that those men have for the city of Valparaiso.
I guess with what time we have left here, Sparrows, let's talk a little about, you've given a good clue as to what's happening this summer, about the prospects for things in the future. One of the things that kind of have come and gone in hand, I suppose, is, and the effort is continuing, is trying to find an opportunity to put in a full-fledged convention center. With the passing, so to speak, of the Star Plaza complex, that's idea. I know it's been taken up and it's still under review, I understand.
Well, a couple weeks ago, the RDA announced that they've selected CSL out of Minneapolis, Convention and Sports Leisure. They are a national leader in doing the feasibility and market analysis for convention centers. The RDA has commissioned a study to see what are the needs, if there are any needs, in Lake County. If there are, the study will address perhaps where it should be located and how big it should be. So, like everyone, I'm waiting. It's in the RDA's hands. That's the right place for it to be. I think that they bring a certain dispassionate objectivity as one of the biggest developers of things in Northwest Indiana, like the Westlake Corridor, like double tracking, all those things. I mean, the RDA's credentials on these are impeccable. And so we're very comfortable having them head this up at the county council's behest. And we look forward to getting those results in 4 or 5 months.
Sparrows Bautistatos is the president and CEO of the South Shore Convention and Visitors Authority. Thank you for spending some time with us on the program today to talk about all these events that have happened. And we're looking forward to getting more information about great summer events coming up here in Northwest Indiana from you folks. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. And visit us at alongthesouthshore.com.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. In part two of the series on President Trump's 2018 budget, we traveled to the southern tip of Lake Michigan. Researchers there trying to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes, but the proposed budget cuts could limit their work. Chuck Wormbach with Wisconsin Public Radio reports for Great Lakes Today.
Some varieties, like the bighead and silver carp, grow to a fearsome 100 pounds and eat their weight in plankton every day. That leaves much less food for other fish. And with Asian carp spreading out in the United States, they're common in the Mississippi and Illinois river systems. That's why the battle to control them is being fought near Lake Michigan.
We are the defensive line in preventing any further movement towards the lake of the fish.
That's Chuck Shea of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He supervises a project that's already spent nearly $18 million from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, an underwater carp barrier. It's in the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal near Romeoville, Illinois, about 40 miles southwest of Chicago. The tugboat Kiowa pushes several barges full of sand and gravel toward the big city. At the bottom of the canal, steel electrodes create a pulsing electric field to deter Asian carp from entering. The Corps of Engineers is upgrading the original barrier, one of three at the site. Shea says the work will strengthen the system.
We've learned that the power levels that the demonstration barrier can operate at limit its effectiveness. It's effective on larger fish, but it is not effective on smaller fish. So by upgrading it, we can make it more effective on a wider range of fish.
Construction won't be affected by Trump's plan to eliminate the $300 million in funding in 2018, but another $500,000 for a follow-up study is in doubt. It would look at ways to stop Asian carp from being dragged or pushed through the barrier by the barges. Likewise, other agencies that use the federal dollars might need to halt their work or look for other funding. Environmentalists respond.
Great Lakes Restoration Initiative dollars are critical to the effort to keep Asian carp out of Lake Michigan.
Molly Flanagan is with the Alliance for the Great Lakes.
Funding from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative goes to the Illinois Department of Natural Resources to help with their harvesting effort to reduce population and the pressure that fish experience to move closer to Lake Michigan. Funding from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative goes to agencies like the U.S. Geological Survey and the Fish and Wildlife Service that are doing different studies to find out what technologies might be useful in the battle against Asian carp.
Ann Flanagan says if the pot of money goes away, it would be tougher to get dollars for stronger protections 20 miles downstream from the barrier, here at the Corps of Engineers Brandon Road Lock and Dam. That horn means the Lamont Trader tug is moving through the lock at Joliet, about 10 miles from the leading edge of the Asian carp invasion. Environmentalists want more safeguards, but the Trump administration is delaying the release of a study on carp control options here. That's good news to Lynn Munch of the American Waterways Operators. The tug and barge trade group says additional structures at the lock could slow commerce. It supports federal money for some research and for harvesting carp from the Illinois River. Munch says other spending should get a close look.
That's why you make a budget. You look at everything and see if the cost benefit is there. And so I would say that's true of everything in the federal budget.
A bipartisan coalition in Congress backs the restoration initiative, so Trump may not be able to zero out the program. But environmentalists say a big reduction in spending could still hurt efforts to halt the Asian carp. For Great Lakes Today, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Our series continues tomorrow. Great Lakes Today is a collaboration of public radio stations WBFO in Buffalo, New York, IdeaStream Cleveland, and WXXI Radio in Rochester, New York. For more stories, go to greatlakestoday.org.
Despite the economic improvements for Hoosier youngsters, Indiana's once again in the middle of the pack when it comes to the overall well-being of our youngsters. That's based on the National 2017 Kids Count Data Book that's come out recently by the Annie E. Casey Foundation. And for that, we turn to Indiana Youth Institute President CEO Tammy Silverman to find out how the Hoosier State fared in this. Tammy, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Always my pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, fill us in, if you will, on how we're standing so far as the economic well-being of youngsters. And of course, it's not only the youngsters themselves, but the families, of course, that support them.
Absolutely. Like you said, Indiana is 28th overall for child well-being, and that's really middle of the pack. So that puts us a little behind. When you look at our Midwestern neighbors, that puts us a little bit behind Illinois and Ohio, but better than Michigan and Kentucky as far as our rankings. And again, we look at, when we talk about that, it's really the four categories of education, economics, family and community, and health. And so it's that 28th is an overall ranking for all four of those categories.
How does that put us, as far as you know, with our Midwestern neighbors?
You know, we did really well this year as far as education. We're 14th, and so we're pretty consistent with Illinois. I know that's important to you all in that area. Illinois is 13th, and so we're combined, both Illinois and Indiana, better than our neighboring states. Economically, we're 19th, so again, pretty good. We struggle with family and community and health, in fact, where we're in the 30s. In health, we're ranked 35th.
Do we find that it's the situation dealing with, unfortunately, the opioid epidemic that has struck Indiana as it has other states, and then, of course, affects families and young people as well? That's why we're not quite as ranked as well on health and related issues?
Right. You're absolutely right. And we know, you know, one of the interesting things there is really what it's doing, what those opioid addictions are doing to the communities themselves. Because interestingly, although we hear all about that, this data told us that as far as teens using drugs and alcohol, there was actually a reduction. But that doesn't mean that the adults aren't using those substances, just like you said. And what that trickle-down impact, what that negative impact can be on kids is really important to pay attention to.
Now, how do we stand on the economic standpoint for Indiana youngsters based on the national data that you've taken a look at?
Again, economically, that's our strongest category. And the one area for this year where we saw the biggest area of improvement was the amount of money households are spending on housing. So the data point definition is high housing burden. And, you know, there was a 22% drop over a five-year period in how much of a household income is being spent on housing. So, again, sometimes you think of that as a parent responsibility, and certainly they're the ones that are paying the rent or the mortgage. But when you think about it, when there's stable housing and when there's affordable housing, that means kids don't move around as much. It also means that home has more money to spend on things like healthy food and health care, as well as enrichment activities such as quality pre-K, books, music lessons, sports lessons, you name it.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, who's President and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, about how Indiana fares in the figures from the annual Kids Count data book that's come out from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. We talked about one E, economics. Let's talk about the other big E as far as young people are concerned in the Hoosier State, education. How do we rank in that this year?
Education, we ranked 14th. So that's pretty strong, really, when, especially when you look at our overall ranking of 28. So education was very strong. And we did see some improvements as far as our attainment rates, our proficiency rates. The number of fourth graders, the way that nationally they look at it, is the number of fourth graders who are considered proficient in reading and the number of eighth graders who are considered proficient in math. And so there was improvement. Now, having said that, we want to still pay attention because there's a big chunk of our kids, about 40% in each of those categories, who still aren't at that proficiency level. So there's still a lot more work for us to do, but we are moving in the right direction.
Now, how about pre-kindergarten programs? We know that the General Assembly has approved and sent on for the governor's approval as well some measures that are going to boost Indiana's pre-K programs. How do we find likely to stand, even though maybe they won't show up in these figures this year, that we can look to them in the years ahead?
You're absolutely right. That is a big hopeful indicator of where we're headed as a state, because we know that kids that have access to that quality pre-K, not just any old pre-K, right, but quality pre-K actually do better over time, and they end up with higher graduation rates and college attainment rates and all of those kinds of things. And, you know, they have stronger employment rates as well. So really, as you said, that is a strong indicator and a really hopeful sign of where we're headed.
Now, how does it appear we're going to be looking ahead to some improvements here? And we know that the Indiana Youth Institute, taking a look at this national data, breaks it out, sees how Hoosier kids are doing. What kind of ideas and suggestions can you make to not only officials and communities and counties, but our state legislators as well, too, about making improvements for the youngsters?
Certainly. And again, we've seen some great signs. You know, one of the biggest areas or one of the biggest surprises for us this year was the data point on the number of teens and children who are dying in our state. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we had a huge increase, an 11% increase in death rates for teens and children. And we've been talking about that for a couple of years, and there are some organizations all over the state that are really working and focusing on, particularly on suicide rates. And the state legislature just passed a bill in this most recent session that is going to create training programs for all educators across the state. So just like you said, you know, we need to be paying attention to the data, but really the data is only as good as what do we do with it and who do we talk to about creating solutions based on the data. So again, there's no one right solution to cure everything. They're pretty intricate, complicated problems, but we are hearing and seeing a lot of folks realizing that you know, we need to pay attention and invest in the well-being of our kids because they're really where our future.
Now, if you'd like to check out the national figures from this latest Kids Count data book, you can go to the Annie E. Casey Foundation's website, which is aecf.org. And obviously, Tammy Silverman, if people would like to take a look at how the Indiana breakouts shape up from that information, they can find it on the Indiana Youth Institute website, can't they?
You betcha, and that is iyi.org.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. Thank you for being with us for the update on the 2017 Kids Count data book and the data that shows up how Indiana ranks in the rankings this year. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you, Chris. Thanks for caring about Indiana's kids.
Over the last few weeks, the details of Central Grocers and the eventual sale of Strachan and Van Til supermarkets have come to light. In the latest episode of the Times of Northwest Indiana's Byline podcast includes hearing from local community leaders at the forefront of the issue and how they are coming to terms with the eventual sale.
I'm Cale Wilk. And this week, Byline looks at the developments of the sale of Strachan Van Til. We'll talk to a professor that will shed light on the state of the grocery industry.
Well, so, I mean, grocery stores usually have very thin profit margins, right? You're making maybe 1, 2, 3% on what you sell.
As well as look at the pressing problems of food deserts.
You know, when you are at the street level and you see how it directly impacts people, you understand it's more than just a store closing. You know, it's a food system that's collapsing for many of these communities.
Right now I'm at the grocery store, Strachan Van Til in Munster, doing my weekly shopping run and stocking up on usual items. I've picked up some lettuce, tomatoes, lunch meat, cheese, bread, oatmeal, and yogurt. The parking lot outside is a little dead. It was a Thursday afternoon, though, so it's not the most hopping. But it may be a sign of the impending future of this store location. Since April, the community has been waiting to see what is going to become of Strachan Van Til, a longtime familiar grocery giant in the region, as well as the partnering stores of Ultra Foods and Town & Country Market. Around the end of that month, the news came out that its parent company, Central Grocers, sometimes called Centrella, was so deep in debt that it wanted to auction 22 of its stores to a buyer. This all comes at an interesting and tough time for grocery stores, the effects of which have been creeping slowly into the region for a while now. And that's what we're going to get into this episode. To start out, let's go back in time a little bit to April 19th, to be exact. Doing this podcast is one of several different tasks I do as a digital producer. And on that day, I was actually doing a web shift, meaning I was the one curating the movement of stories on the Times' website and social media accounts. And on that day, there were some tips that came our way. Several to this episode's featured reporter.
Oh, they had employee meetings where they told employees that there was a pending sale, that they were going to close nearly half of their locations, that there are only going to be 22 stores remaining. And obviously some people were upset. They were confused. In times like that, people call the press to figure out, you know, what's going on. Can somebody get, you know, some information on this?
That's Joseph Pete again, who is our talented business reporter that often is behind breaking business news in the region.
We get constant tips about closing or, you know, things that don't pan out. You know, at first I was just hoping this was, you know, something, you know, hoping there was nothing to it. It was just, you know, but then we got a couple more. And then so I immediately started, you know, putting out calls and emails and trying to figure out what was going on. I discovered some of my previous contacts at the company had apparently been laid off, but I was able to then get a, without being previously aware of that, but then was able to get a hold of people. And then the facts started to kind of pour out about what was going on.
And so he wrote up and put out a story that afternoon about the planned sale of Strachan Van Til. Joseph continued to follow this huge development for weeks as more details came out. There was a lawsuit by a union to make sure a labor agreement was honored, an announcement of layoffs, when operations would be expected to wind down, as well as the analysis that the parent company was $225 million in debt, and that thousands of creditors came in eventually to participate in the sale. The end result, as far as we can tell for now, based on when this episode has premiered, is there are 22 stores Central Grocers has been trying to sell, as well as its warehouse in Joliet, Illinois. There's been interest expressed by Jewel Osco, a grocery chain headquartered in Itasca, Illinois, that has stores throughout the Chicago metro area, including many already in the region that are familiar among residents. But the thing about the sale is it really ends up being more than just a bidder and liquidation scenario.
We're still trying to unpack like some of the impact and everything, but Central Grocers had been supplied nearly 400 independent grocery stores throughout Chicago, Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland. Basically, if you go through Hammond, you go through East Chicago, you go through anywhere and you see those little corner stores, or, you know, independent ones really anywhere, their supplier was most likely Central Grocers.
One of those effects is the hit to local business. Strachan Van Til was a huge, locally operated institution in the region, and one of the two largest locally owned chains in Indiana. The same effects have interestingly enough been felt by Marsh Supermarkets, headquartered in Indianapolis. The company has also been announcing closings. When I was in Bloomington at Indiana University, there were at least two of those stores in the city, and during my senior year, one of them announced it was closing. That locally owned status really ends up meaning something, though. Strachan Van Til has been my go-to place for groceries while I was growing up, and even up until now. It's where my family has gone to get our meals for Thanksgiving, chicken pieces for dinners from its deli, or just a quick stop if we needed to pick up something.
Well, we've had the, I've had Strack's Chicken and, like, Mostaccioli, like, literally probably dozens, if not scores of times, like, over the course of my life. It's been a staple of different parties and family gatherings. We've, you know, shopped there to get stuff to feed, like, the extended family for Christmas or Thanksgiving. I've heard stories about, like, you know, weddings where the caterer flaked out and it felt, you know, those was almost going to be a crisis. But a couple people, like, got in the car real quick, made a run to Strack's, and it saved the wedding.
But that locally owned status also meant a huge community investor and employer. Streck and Van Til had a massive web of connections in regards to donations. And Joseph also reported that there could be over 1,000 layoffs as a result of this. There's not necessarily a guarantee all of them could find a job with whoever purchases these stores. Recall that in the last two episodes on population loss and gain in the region, job growth was not necessarily a positively trending statistic for the area. These developments certainly don't bode well for that either.
It's like an integral part to our local community. It's something that distinguishes us. Like, you know, you want to have some individuality or uniqueness to your community, something that you guys built yourselves, something that isn't just like some, you know, you don't want this wallpaper suburban landscape where everything is a Panera Bread or a Noodles and Company or a Target or, you know, some other business where, you know, you're sending all your money out of the community too. They've been an incredible local sponsor for a number of nonprofits, for a number of youth sports and athletic leagues. They've had their hands in so much. When you have some distant corporation like Walmart, they don't care. They have a budget of like, you know, some of these out-of-state ones will have a budget of like $10,000 for giving back to the community. They're not going to spend anywhere near as much as, you know, Strack and Van Til had on local philanthropic and charitable causes.
However, if we look at the trail of how we got to here, this might have been something that was very slowly coming down the tracks based on shopping preferences and trends. To help explain that, I talked with this person.
Sure. I'm Micah Pollack. I'm assistant professor of economics at Indiana University Northwest.
Micah has been at the school since 2012 and keeps a tab on developments in the business realm through various research projects. In regards to grocery stores, it's not an industry that's really all that stable to begin with.
Well, so, I mean, grocery stores usually have very thin profit margins, right? You're making maybe 1%, 2%, 3% on what you sell. And on top of that, you have a lot of, like, perishable goods that you have to deal with. You know, also, like, deli and kind of prepared foods, stuff that doesn't necessarily last very long, so you have a lot of waste. And I guess the grocery store industry itself hasn't, you know, it's always had those thin profit margins, which isn't necessarily a problem unless there's a lot of other things happening causing stress, right? So when the market's changing very rapidly, you don't have kind of a bigger buffer of profit margins to kind of weather the storm. And so that's kind of why you see things happening as quickly as you do in kind of the grocery industry.
And shopping preferences have changed. There's popularity in searching for organic options, often available at places like Whole Foods, which has become a dominant name in grocery chains. If you walk into one of those stores, another eye-catching feature is its food stations or courts where meals are hot and ready. Or there's appeal in one-stop shopping offered by Target, Walmart, or Meijer, where you can shop for tools or clothing, and then you can go pick up frozen dinners on another side of the store. There's even delivery options like Blue Apron, where your meals get delivered to your door in a refrigerated box, complete with recipes. And it seems Strack and Van Til made an effort to compete with these features. It renovated several stores and updated their interiors, installed food stations, boosted local offerings from Northwest Indiana's craft brewers as an example, and even offered an online ordering system where your groceries could be picked out by workers and available to pick up at the door when it was ready. But that just didn't seem to be enough.
And the rebranding of the stores is a big part of competing more with places like Whole Foods, and it's not just rebranding the stores. It's also things like I mentioned, you know, offering sushi in the stores and, you know, curbside pickup and home delivery and ordering online and a whole variety of things trying to find kind of a niche in the grocery industry today, which is what not just Track, but all the other grocery stores are kind of doing as well, as they face challenges from, like, not just Whole Foods, but, you know, Menards is carrying more groceries and more and produce and things like that. And convenience stores are expanding. And so you're kind of getting assault on all the different fronts. You know, you can order things from Amazon and kind of Blue Apron and all these kind of online meal prep places now. And so how do you exist in a grocery store, as a grocery store, in that kind of environment when you only have like a couple percentage points of profit margin to even kind of work with, you know, to try to adapt?
What this also ends up speaking to is the ever-creeping effects of the dubbed retail apocalypse, where brick-and-mortar stores are finding themselves having to close up shop. Joseph has written several stories on region restaurants that were staples as well, having to close.
So here in Northwest Indiana, obviously, you know, we were steel manufacturing history, and then automation, you know, productivity changes led to us needing fewer workers to do the same jobs as before. And so that kind of broader trend of automation is continuing. And often people say, well, you know, that's okay because we've got retail sales, which are relatively safe. You know, we can go work in grocery stores and retail shops. And that's really not necessarily going to be true in the long run. I mean, you see increase in productivity across the board. And so even though it may not be obvious how you replace a grocery store worker with a robot or some kind of automated device, you know, you do have that happen, whether it's self-checkout or things like that. And so it's a good reminder that really no job is immune to new technology and innovation and productivity changes. So that's kind of like the automation side of things. But then on the other hand, what you're talking about with community currency, there's, you know, if times are tough and your budgets are tight, you're going to care more about the bottom line dollar that you have to spend for something. So you're going to go to kind of the bigger chains where you can get maybe lower prices because they deal in, you know, larger volumes. But it's important to remember that you get value as a consumer from not just, you know, buying the product, but also from who you support and kind of where you buy the good. So maybe it's a little more expensive buying something at a local store that's a mom and pop store rather than a big chain. But if you value that type of community, then that's something you would be willing to maybe pay a little extra for.
But another question that's looming is, how is this going to affect local food supplies and food security, particularly among low-income communities? We've touched on how the sale of Strack and Van Til's stores is going to bring about some consequences with local employment and investment in community entities. But now, what about making sure there's enough food to actually go around? Or what about basic access to it and the concept of food deserts? I wanted to try and get down to the community level here and see what people felt. So I went to Ultra Foods just off of Ridge Road in an unincorporated part of Gary. Gary itself isn't a place where many grocery options are available at all. Within the sale of Central Grocer stores, three Ultra Foods locations weren't desired to be purchased, and thus are being liquidated. There were signs on the windows on the day I went, which was Monday, saying the store had 6 days left of being open. I tried to do a man-on-the-street-style form of interviewing by asking people how they felt about the Strack and Van Til situation, how far they had to commute from to get to this particular store, and if its closing is going to affect how they get groceries. Although, after standing outside for a while, I was approached by management and asked to leave, saying that I was soliciting. However, of the people I asked, I managed to get thoughts from one woman, named Joan Smith from Hammond.
It's bad for the employees. They're left in the dark not knowing anything, which I think is a shame for them.
Yeah, and you know, in regards to, how often do you shop here?
Once every couple of weeks.
Okay, so then, you know, with the store closing, is that going to affect how you, you know, end up getting groceries?
Is probably it gonna not so much me, because I live in Hammond.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it is nice, you know, to come here when they run their sales and stuff. It's close to home, so it's a real shame.
So you think, are you going to have to travel farther then to go and get groceries, do you think, or?
No, not necessarily. I mean, we got plenty of small stores by us, but it's nice, you know, to come to the big stores here sometime and find things I can't find in the little stores. So, not too often.
Okay.
We also put a call out on the Times' social media channels asking if there were regular shoppers or even employees at Ultra Foods that were going to be affected by the store's closings, and if they would want to share their thoughts with us. We didn't receive any responses from that method. And I'd like to note something about this, too. Going into this line of questioning, I understood it probably wasn't going to be entirely successful. This is definitely a difficult matter in trying to approach someone about being laid off, or their potential status of living in a food desert, or being low income. We don't mean to come across as insensitive and do this with the most respect possible. But understand that our mission as journalists is to report news, and in turn document history. Decades later, someone may look back at this and be curious to find the most complete picture possible on how the community felt when its largest locally owned grocery store finally ended its reign after decades of being in existence. But shoppers, of course, aren't the only option to talk to about this. I also reached out to those on the advocacy front, particularly the Northwest Indiana Food Council. So I was able to organize an interview with this person.
I'm Ann Massey. I'm president of the Northwest Indiana Food Council. And I also work in distribution with a few northern Indiana farms like Seven Sons and Pastures Delights.
And she was also able to bring along this person to join us.
I'm Terry Saltzman with Purdue Lake County Extension Office, and I'm what they call Community Wellness Coordinator.
Both the Food Council and Purdue Extension Office are involved in the communities in various but similar ways. The Food Council gets right down to the community level by seeking and pushing for sustainable food systems and access for all of Northwest Indiana, particularly in its food insecure locations. Purdue Extension is headed by Purdue University in West Lafayette and provides research and suggestions for solutions in all 92 of Indiana's counties, the food solutions being one of the topics under its umbrella. As two people that are very much involved with producing community solutions, I was first curious what their initial reactions were to the Strack and Van Til news in April.
It was bad news. It made me heartsick because not only did those stores provide a retail outlet for low-income audiences because their prices were within their range, but a lot of those stores, too, also supplied the food pantries with, you know, some of their leftover items. And so now we have a double stress.
Yeah, I have much of the same sentiment. I was heartbroken. I come from a family business that's been around for nearly 100 years, and the mom-and-pop operations, the locally owned businesses, are such an important part to the vitality of our community. And seeing that our last locally owned grocery store chain couldn't make it is really disheartening and a little bit scary in terms of what the food pantry is going to do now.
And I was also curious what they had observed in regards to community reactions.
Yeah, I have one food pantry specifically in Gary who actually came to my office because they are so concerned about what they're going to do. Ultra specifically provided them with quite a bit of their food, and they are open once a week, every week, this food pantry, and they see an increase almost every week in the number of people that they're serving, and now they're kind of like scrambling to figure out where they're going to get the needed supplies from. So, you know, she was literally crying, begging me to try to figure out what can be done to help her get that food for these families. And now you have summer coming up. Kids are going to be out of school, so they won't be getting school lunches. So even more food is going to be needed for the kids. And it's heartbreaking. You know, when you are at the street level and you see how it directly impacts people, you understand it's more than just a store closing. You know, it's a food system that's collapsing for many of these communities.
I wanted to get an idea of what food deserts exist in Northwest Indiana. The USDA's website defines it as such. A food desert is a low-income census tract where either a substantial number or share of residents has low access to a supermarket or large grocery store. Low-income tracts are defined as those where at least 20% of the people have income at or below the federal poverty levels for family size, or where median family income for the tract is at or below 80% of the surrounding area's median family income. Tracts qualify as low-access tracts if at least 500 persons, or 33% of their population, live more than a mile from a supermarket or large grocery store. For rural census tracts, the distance is more than 10 miles.
Sure. This is a map of Lake County, and you will see that there are some areas here shaded in dark green, and those are USDA-designated food deserts within Lake County.
Terry had brought a map that showed where the food deserts were in Northwest Indiana. I understand that affluence and resources aren't spread equally across the region, but in this context, it was worse than I thought.
As a matter of fact, 21 to 25% of Lake County is considered a food desert. And
does that also show some of Porter and LaPorte counties?
Yeah,
too?
Just portions. You can see a little bit of, not of LaPorte, but of Porter County right here. We do have this major food desert here up by Portage. And maybe like a couple right here in some of the rural areas. But this is East Chicago right here, and then this is the Illinois line. This is mostly Gary, and then we have some of Merrillville through, down through, it's like northern Merrillville, it's right here. Mm-hmm. We have some of Lake Station in there, a little bit of Highland, not too much.
But just because a physical grocery store may not exist in a large swath of land doesn't mean there isn't any food at all. It's available, often in processed or packaged forms at a corner store or gas station. But more often than not, those are not healthy options.
And one of the other, you know, I think stereotypical things that I hear a lot is, well, you know, she's going in and buying a big gulp and a bag of potato chips, so mm-hmm. She's obviously, you know, she could go a few days without eating anyway. But when folks have to go into the corner store and purchase most of what they eat, there's no healthy options for them, or either they are priced out of their price range. Mm-hmm.
So in order to get to a grocery store, some families may have the luxury of an automobile, and some may rely on a bus system, if one even exists. If not, then what do you do? With some of these grocery stores being slated to close, like the Ultra Foods that I stopped at, that's creating another hole for many of those people nearby there. And Merrillville is slated to lose 2 grocery stores, which definitely presents a problem for that area as well. Anne also noted in this interview her concerns on what the status of SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps, and WIC, the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, would be. Analyses of the Trump administration's budget proposal show millions of dollars in cuts to spending programs like SNAP. A development like that puts even more pressure on hungry families struggling to get food in a food desert or from a food bank.
If you have a third of your population or more that does not have transportation or access to transportation, so even if there is a grocery store within, you know, a few minute drive, if you have a third of your residents that don't have transportation, it doesn't mm-hmm. matter a whole lot.
Well, and especially too, when you look at, you know, try to do this experiment yourself, get on a bus and go to the grocery store and mm-hmm. see how much you can logistically carry back. You know, especially if you're a senior citizen or you've got 3 children tagging along behind you, it's not easy. Mm-hmm. It is not easy at all. So,
and not all of our grocery stores accept SNAP and WIC, which is another mm-hmm. obstacle mm-hmm. for a lot of families, that they can finally get to the store, that it actually has affordable pricing and mm-hmm. accepts EBT.
And I think the rate of the SNAP benefits, too, has not kept pace with inflation.
Yeah.
So the SNAP dollar actually buys less today than it did 2 years ago. So we have a number of mitigating factors going on at the same time.
But couldn't one just decide, all right, we'll help and build a grocery store here in this affected area? That kind of seems like what happened nearby in Chicago when Whole Foods in the city announced in 2013 it would install a store in the city's Englewood neighborhood. Not only a place that's a food desert, but also a Southside location notorious for its crime. But arranging such a deal is a little more difficult. Terry would point out that it involves making sure there's going to be demand for a store in the first place. And she says that there often indeed is in low-income areas like this.
Because I did some research, and Gary is actually losing $42 million a year on people shopping outside of Gary for food. So if they had some market opportunities back in Gary, they could potentially recapture some of that $42 million. So there's a little bit of an assumption, too, that when you see a food desert, that there's no demand left there for mm-hmm. for healthy food. And that's a really bad assumption to make, because it's absolutely not true.
A concern, as mentioned before by Ann and Terry, is what is going to happen with the local food banks, who had a bolster in supplies and monetary donations from Strack and Van Til. So I reached out to the Food Bank of Northwest Indiana to take a temperature check and was able to speak with Steve Beekman, the executive director.
Yeah, well, we're the leader in the fight against hunger in the region. We've been doing it for 3 decades, and every day we try to acquire, store, and distribute meals to people in need, specifically here in Lake and Porter County. And we do that through our partner agencies, and which are food pantries and soup kitchens. And we serve about 22,000 people every month through our programs and services.
According to a yearly summary from 2016, the food bank says it distributed 4.2 million meals across Lake and Porter counties that year. It estimates it serves around 22,000 people each month, equivalent, it says, to around 15,000 households. Streck and Van Til has assisted the food bank since its inception in the 1980s. Food banks are part of a much larger picture of food insecurity in the U.S. The USDA reported that food insecurity declined to 12.7% in 2015, down from a high of 14.9% in 2011. But it also notes that 5% of those insecure were in very low food security, meaning their normal eating patterns are disrupted significantly due to a lack of resources. And in 7.8% of that, children were food insecure.
You can hear the entire podcast at NWI.com. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow. We'll learn more about this coming Thursday's Diversity Career Fair and Symposium that's going to be held at Avalon Manor in Merrillville. That's here on Regionally Speaking.